Hello. Now then, I'd like you to listen to a couple of sounds.
It was a complete creation of his own making.
I was the very, very first in the whole world.
I've got plenty of other people. I've got four sisters and two brothers. They've all got plenty of kids. I've got plenty of kids on Jimbo Fixie. So my kids, to me anyway, the best sorts of kids, is they all go home to their parents.
Me to do things for him. He wants me to fondle him. He asked me for oral sex.
We gave him every instrument that he needed in Broughton to prey on some extremely damaged individuals.
Sir James Savile, OBE, the man who has single-handedly raised more than £30 million for charity.
Why have you said in interviews that you don't have emotions?
Because it's easier. The truth is, I'm very good at masking them.
I'm a rare breed insofar as I'm a single fella, and which is why when people say, them five places you've got to live in, aren't they expensive? And I say, not as expensive as a wife.
Now, the Metropolitan Police say that it will now take the lead in investigating sex abuse allegations against the late Sir Jimmy Savile as more women come forward claiming to have been assaulted by the television presenter.
Who's your best pal, Tony?
Oh, no, Desmond.
He's not.
He is.
No, he's not.
Get off me.
Because he's a married man.
Do you care?
Yes, you do.
Get off.
I won't.
No, just
question. Not until you say me.
Now, me, when I stand in front of the table and St. Peter's there, he says, you are not coming in. And I'll say, well, why not? And he'll say, because you're a villain. And he'll show me the debit side. And I'll say, hang about. And I'll show him the credit side. And he'll say, does that mean anything? And if he says, that means nothing, then I'll threaten to break his fingers.
What does she do with the cable, boys?
And I didn't want to. And he promised me that if I gave him oral sex, that he would arrange for me and my friends to go to Television Central and be on his television show.
Hey, hey, hey! We've got it all happening tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody's around. We're going to start with our guests.
Hope it's been a very good week for you, and here's a very good set of fixes for you. Here we go now with a letter from Leeds. Yeah, Leeds.
Me?
So, I promise. That you, Jimmy Savile.
You, Jimmy Savile.
Are the only one.
Are the only one.
In my life.
I was 14. Of course I wanted to go to Television Centre. I didn't want to give him more facts. I thought it was disgusting, but I did that. Gary Glitter was one example. He was particularly horrible and only interested in getting as much sex as he could possibly get from any girl.
I'd start with manipulative, then controlling, and very, very clever.
It has become a great British institution. Not bad for just another zany DJ, but there's a lot more to cigar-smoking Jimmy than meets the eye.
I can remember seeing him having sex with one of the girls from Duncroft in Jimmy Savile's dressing room.
I was the very, very first in the whole world to run a dance to record.
You used to be a wrestler, didn't you?
I need a lamp.
Are you?
I'm feared in every girls' school in this country.
Hello and welcome once again to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Todd, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our 10th look at the life and crimes of Jimmy Savile. Like to apologize that there was no show last week, but unfortunately, since moving back cross country, I have discovered an awful thing called allergies, and I was unable to speak without coughing and hacking up a lung. Before we get into it, we have our normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, that would be Facebook, Instagram, MeWe, YouTube. Just search for Ian Totten, author, or The Deathcast. If you'd like to follow the show on Twitter, you can find it at Corpse Creek. You can check out the show's official website, CorpseCreekPublishing.com. While there, please consider signing up for the mailing list and possibly clicking on the donate button. buy me a cup of coffee for all the effort I put into putting this show out. If you like the Deathcast, please consider subscribing wherever it is you find your favorite podcasts, and please consider leaving a 5-star review. They do really do help get the show to more people. And if you would like to help keep this show going, help offset the costs of production, please consider going to tinyurl.com/DC Patreon. That's tinyurl.com/DC Patreon. For as little as $2 a month, you can become a supporter of this show. If you are interested in finding any of the 6 novels I have put out, go to tinyurl.com/Totten-books. That will take you to my Amazon author page where the 6 books that I have put out can be found in various formats, including paperback, ebook, and audiobook. Now that the plugs are out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, sit back and relax. I've got my coffee, I got my cigarettes, it's a beautiful day out of 90 degrees. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last time, Jimmy Savile had moved from being a superstar and was on a course to become a megastar within British society. He had gone from being just a run-of-the-mill television personality / presenter and DJ to a household name, and this was due in large part to the introduction of the television show Jim'll Fix It. It's kind of hard to quantify what a cultural phenomenon Jim'll Fix It was within Great Britain. I mean, honestly, there hasn't never been a show in the United States that I could even compare it to in terms of not only popularity, but what it did to its host. It took Jimmy Savile from this odd individual who's been given an OBE, is doing a lot of charity work, and it really put him up on a pedestal. It shined a light on him in such a way that many others who came after him would aspire to be like Savile, although none of them came even close to being on the same plane as he was. I'm sure there are those who will think that I'm blowing smoke as far as just how popular this show made Jimmy. But the reality is, he was like the Beatles of television show presenters. Wherever he went, crowds formed. Anything that he did on a public scale, people came out in droves to support him and be seen with him and just experience Jimmy Savile. So he's got this television show. He's still doing Top of the Pops and Speakeasy. He's still doing all of his radio programs and throwing himself headfirst into his charity work. And since his mother, Agnes, had died, charity work really had begun to take over the majority of Savile's personal life. The start of 1976 saw Savile take place in the Land's End Walk, which went from Land's End to London, span of roughly 291 miles, and Savile did this in order to raise $1,000 for charity. Some people who knew Savile thought that him continuing to do these physical feats, these marvels, was Savile's attempt to try and hold back the hands of time, because by 1976 he's already pushing 50 years old. The public image he was given, however, was still that of a fairly young man. It's just conjecture on my part, but I believe that is one of the many reasons why he continued to do these things, but he also continued to take advantage of the young women who present themselves to him. And because somebody made a comment about this not long ago, when I say young women, it's just a collective term. I'm not trying to be disrespectful of the underage girls who fell victim to Seville, whether it was by his own chicanery or by their own volition, which there were a lot of. I use it really just as a catch-all. And by this point, 1976, he is skyrocketing in popularity. There were a lot of these encounters. In fact, the Metropolitan Police Department, based in London, has come out and said that this period of time was Seville's most prolific. Now, when they use those terms, they are talking specifically about the myth that Seville was a strict pedophile who targeted underage girls. As I've talked about numerous times until I'm blue in the face, the reality of the situation couldn't be further from the truth. Seville took advantage of everyone who was between a certain age range, specifically age 14 until the early 20s. And again, in Great Britain at this time, the age of consent was 16. The majority of Seville's victims were around the age of 16. Young women who came to see him at one of his public events or when he was recording a television show or who got tied into one of the various teams that he had set up around the United Kingdom who Seville would take advantage of. A great example of how Seville, who now is getting this air of respectability, comes from a disc jockey who was 17 years old who ended up getting into trouble with the law. Newspapers went out and stated basically that a lot of these disc jockeys were putting themselves into a position where they could get in trouble, being that they were around so many young girls. A number of disc jockeys came out and fired back, stating that it wasn't their problem that these young girls threw themselves at them and that they made certain that all of them were of age. Seville, as normal, took a different approach, stating, quote, "The geezer's 100% right. If you get into clubs and places like that, you are coming up against all sorts of temptations. Drugs and underage birds and things. This is the 1976 temptation. Some of us go down and some of us don't. It's the responsibility of the person involved." A couple of individuals who knew Seville, specifically his producer on Jim'll Fix It, Roger Ordish, has gone on the record stating that that line from Seville, he took to mean that Seville understood just what was coming with the popularity of Jim'll Fix It, and that he was beginning to be looked at as something of an elder statesman within British life, and because of that, Seville went into a mode of possibly cleaning up his act a little bit, but at the very least, making certain that he covered his tracks all the better. And I really believe that is what Seville did from this point on, which is why I do not believe a lot of these stories that came out after he passed of him abusing people in the hospitals that he was working in full view of other people. It flies in the face of reality, not only in that many of these people who came forward were much too young for Seville to even look at in that manner, but also in that Seville was a very cold and calculating individual who really looked at what is this going to do for my career or to my career. He's the type of individual who would understand that if he is sexually abusing 40 or 50 kids over a span of 2 years in these hospitals, eventually something is going to come out of it. And despite how much money and power and influence he had, Seville was smart enough to know that if he got caught up in some sort of scandal in that regard, it would be the end of his career. He saw it happen throughout the years to numerous people who were extremely popular, very powerful, which is why I believe he stuck to those individuals who he knew would not say anything, but also who were within his sphere of influence. And by that, I mean specifically the young girls and women who were a part of his teams and willingly went along with the things that he wanted them to do. Did Jimmy Seville have sexual activities on the grounds of the various hospitals that he donated his time to? Undoubtedly. There are numerous records of this. There are also numerous records of him being allowed to keep campers on the grounds of some of these places, such as at Broadmoor Hospital and Stoke Mandeville. And there are also records of Seville showing up with young women in tow. Just as there are records of nurses coming forward and stating that Seville pressured them to have sexual relations with him. It's a much different animal than Seville molested a 6-year-old girl in full view of the entire staff of the emergency room. Proof to back this up is one of the profiles that was done by a BBC magazine where it stated that Jimmy Seville has graduated from disc jockey to personality, and now he has to be. He serves on advisory hospital boards and rubs shoulders with royalty, a member of the establishment, in fact. That is the reality. From this point on, Jimmy Seville is no longer just an odd, goofy disc jockey. He has moved into the upper stratosphere, if you will, of British hierarchical social circles. He's no longer rubbing shoulders with a member of royalty. He is now moving among the circles of all royalty, and as we're going to see as the years progress in future episodes, Seville gets very, very close to the top tier of the British royal family. I'm talking about Prince Charles and Lady Diana. He's also being pushed in campaigns all across Britain as the face of companies and corporations, so than possibly anyone else in Great Britain during this period of time. And it really all stems from the popularity that came with the first season of Jim Will Fix It. And that popularity just continues to explode and grow as 1976 moves on. He's given a Grand Order of the Knights of Malta, which is a Catholic organization. He's also set to march for peace in Belfast, Ireland again. While all of this is going on, Seville finally takes a public stance in regards to politics by blasting the Labour Party for their 90% tax on the highest earners in society. And in doing so, Seville made one of the very few mistakes that he is known to have made during his career, and that is letting the Salford Council know that he was still paying £10 a week in rent for his apartment at the Ascot Court on Newbury Road. As I understand it, these flats were really for low-income individuals, and it was one of those places that Seville had gotten into when he first was getting started. Seville had kept this apartment for years, despite the increase in his yearly revenue. Because Seville was one of those individuals, as so many extremely wealthy elite are, that understand that if you want to keep what you have, you cannot spend it. You need to hold on to as much of it as possible. And when questioned about this and it was put to him by various reporters, Seville pretty much shrugged it off as being a non-issue, despite the fact that it was very well known that in addition to everything else he had going on, he was also the owner of a nightclub in Bournemouth, known as the Mason Royal, that had been valued at over £1 million. This comment about his $10 a week apartment ended up blowing up in Seville's face, appearing in newspapers all across the country, so much so that Seville called up a man by the name of Dave Eager, who was pretty much his handler at this point, and telling him, quote, go to the caretaker, get the keys, take all my personal possessions out of the flat. Was one of those individuals who did not like to end up with egg on his face. This is one of the rare occasions where he did. People were really blasting him publicly for having this apartment, despite the fact that he attempted to play it off and show his largesse by stating that he was leaving all of his furniture and his television, provided the city council make certain that the apartment goes to a needy couple. The public, however, was not buying this particular line from Seville. In the midst of all this, Seville turned around and sold the family home, Consort Terrace in Leeds. In the summer of 1976, Seville had another small blunder when he went to a place called Henlow Grange, which was something of a health farm in Bedfordshire. Supposedly, Seville did this in order to prepare himself to do a swimming crossing of the English Channel in a day. So Seville ended up meeting a 16-year-old girl by the name of Julie Ball. I give her name here because this young woman came forward publicly at the time, stating that she worked at the health farm as a beautician in training, and that Seville had immediately become smitten with her, so much so that he insisted on driving her home when her shift had ended, at which point he gave local children an autograph. The following evening, he took Belle out to a show, although they ended up having to leave early because Seville's presence caused a massive commotion. Following their leaving of this show, Seville drove the young woman around for a period of time before finding a nice place where they could park. And according to Belle, who came forward to the news of the world, she stated that she thought she was in love with Seville, and that we sat and talked, then he climbed into the passenger seat beside me, we kissed and cuddled for half an hour, and he kept on saying this was special, he was very passionate. This is important because it's really the first time that anyone who has had any type of intimate relationship with Seville has come forward publicly, especially during his lifetime. and stated that they were involved with Seville. It's also important to note, because of Julie Bell's age, which she gives at this during this period of time as being 16. Naturally, Seville fired back when the papers put these claims out there, stating, quote-unquote, "Yes, I took her for a spin in my car. It was, I thought, a treat for her after the kindness her family had shown me, but no way did we stop for a kiss and a cuddle." Seville further went on to state that Julie's mother had actually contacted him, claiming that a freelance reporter had offered the girl $50 for the story, and Seville, who liked to play up that everything he did was for others, told the young girl to take the money, obviously because $50 back then was a good sum. It's very, very possible that Seville did in fact tell the mother this, and I say that because Seville was very shrewd and nearly bulletproof, and I'm almost certain that he saw this as a way to further test that, you know, Kevlar shell he had built around himself. We will get back to that in just a moment.
From Ian Totten, best-selling author, The House of Silver Blood Gotch Trilogy, and the Throwaway Girls of Olympia, comes Maggie, a book which New York Times best-selling author Keith Elliott Greenberg has called a classic detective story, well-crafted, and a supernatural vortex. Maggie, the name was burned into Lieutenant Carl Jablonski's mind like a brand, and had been since the night of the fire. He doubted he would ever forget that night, or how she had danced in the flames of her burning home. Maggie, who was she, and why did no one in Kaya's Crossing seem interested in talking about her or her family? These were questions without answers. Quandaries that drove Carl on as he explored the darkest of the town's secrets, desperate to unravel the knots that tied everything together. Maggie, Carl felt haunted by a visage, even as the local reporter, George Murphy, told him of the blood-soaked history that lay along their path, and the horrors that it held. None of it seemed real, and yet it was. The sacrifices, the screams, the pact with the Nameless Ones, and the hell that she had endured. Maggie, hers was a crime begging to be solved, and he and George are the only ones with enough heart to do it. The real question is, will they survive long enough to do it? Maggie, available 11/30/2021 in paperback and hardcover. E-book pre-orders are now available at Amazon.com. Only from Corpse Creek Publishing. You have been warned.
We are back. You can find that book at tinyurl.com/Maggie-Book. Julie Bell came out after hearing what Seville had to say and told the News of the World he must be trying to preserve his image. Again, whether or not things happened the way that Julie said they happened or the way that Seville said they happened is left up to the imagination, although I have to side with Julie on this one because she was the exact age range that Seville was looking for. And as I have already said, I'm sure he did tell the mother that, yes, she should go forward with this. The girl can make a couple dollars of it because he felt that he was bulletproof. And I think that his mindset on this changed once he saw the type of traction that it was getting in the press. It's also known that Seville became involved with an 18-year-old chambermaid when he was at Henlow Grange, and that this young woman, too, came forward to the newspapers, according to this young woman whose name has never been publicly revealed. Seville made comments about her body and her chest, which quickly escalated to groping, before eventually Seville had her bring him back breakfast in his room, at which point he was lying naked on the bed with an erection. This young woman told the papers, "I felt disgusted and humiliated. I tried everything not to be sent back to his room again." Although this young woman's story has never been able to be corroborated, to the best of my knowledge, Seville never even made comments about this, whether it was to the papers or to anyone else. In June of 1978, Seville was honored with an award by the Variety Club, which was really a who's who of British society. Everyone from politicians to celebrities and members of the royal family were members of this. Naturally, Seville was given this award because of the amount of charities he had helped, most notably his crowdfunding for youth charities. This is just another example of Seville being accepted by the establishment and held up on a pedestal for others to try and emulate. One interesting story that comes out during this time is that Seville went on Michael Parkinson's television show and boasted about how he was able to get a 13-year-old girl inside the grounds to Buckingham Palace, specifically because this young woman apparently wanted to meet Prince Andrew, who, if you followed anything having to do with the Jeffrey Epstein case, has become a very big talking point in recent years. However, I can't state whether or not this story is true. There is no evidence to confirm or deny it. We only have this interview of Seville telling this story while those around him on the set are laughing, as Seville regales them by stating that he hid the young girl in the trunk of his car before bringing her inside, and then, or so Seville states, he gets her into the palace, and the girl is dumbfounded when she walks into one of the halls, and people are standing there, mostly guards, and they salute her as though she were someone of noble blood. Personal opinion, I think this is just Seville, you know, blowing smoke to try and make an otherwise dull story more exciting and palatable for the public. He probably was able to get this girl inside of the palace, although I doubt it was as grand and sneaky as he said. She very well could have wanted to meet someone within the royal family, and given Seville's connections and the things he did for charity, it may have just been one of those things that he was able to line up for her. As all this is going on, Seville's popularity continues to increase with the Jim'll Fix It television program. At this point in time, it's getting roughly 16 million viewers a week. Because of this, some stories have come out about Seville nixing certain individuals who would send in letters to the show trying to get a fix-it done. one story has an individual stating that Seville was looking through one of the letters, or rather, it was being read to him, and when he found out the woman's age of being 25, Seville is supposed to have said she's much too old, walnut, which was Seville's way of trying to say that she was old and wrinkled at that point. The people who were involved with Jim Will Fix It at this point have stated that they really believed Seville was trying to turn over a new leaf in his personal life at this point due to the popularity of the show as well as to how he was being viewed within the public eye, but that didn't stop Seville from having instances pop up here and there, one of which was getting thrown off of the luxury liner, the SS Canberra, after complaints came in from the parents of a 14-year-old girl who Seville was apparently harassing on the cruise, as well as the complaints of a 16-year-old who Seville continuously tried to get to come into his cabin. This is one of those stories that has come out after Seville died, so again, it may be true, it may not be true. More likely than not, again, my personal opinion, I have a feeling that just given to his level of celebrity, these girls may have gravitated to Seville on this cruise, and when their parents either learned what had gone on between a 51-year-old man and their daughters, or saw them hanging around with Seville, the parents said that this is not going to happen, this is BS, at which point they brought it to the attention of the captain, and Seville was asked to leave. Now again, this came out after Seville's passing. According to the captain, who has never come forward publicly, when he was given all of this information, he ordered Seville be kept in his room under 24-hour observation, at which point he was not allowed to leave for any reason until they reached Gibraltar, at when he would be thrown off. I think this is a bit of revisionist history, and I say this given how powerful a man Jimmy Seville was at this period of time, who he was friends with, and the level of celebrity that he had. This is the kind of thing that would have come out in newspapers, regardless of how careful Seville was. But not only that, had this happened, Seville would have destroyed this man's life. There's no other way to put it. He more than had the means to take a lowly captain of a luxury cruise liner and lead him to destitution. He didn't just have friends who ran corporations. He had friends who were board members within these corporations, as well as royalty who were friends of his. Had this captain taken these steps to punish Jimmy Seville out in the middle of the ocean, it more likely than not would have been the captain's very last cruise, and he would have been sued into oblivion for daring to oppose Seville. But that's just my opinion on, given what I know about the type of man Seville was. The following year, 1978, saw the publication of a book called God'll Fix It, which was basically Jimmy Seville's recollections on his faith as well as, you know, the way he was able to line up his personal and private life with his religious convictions. There's a lot of passages in this book that are somewhat, I don't know how to say it, they're on shaky ground. Seville does, in fact, talk quite a bit about sex in this book, which, at that period of time, for a celebrity to talk about sex in any fashion was kind of looked down upon. But Seville really did his best to downplay his behavior as looking at it in the, when I'm dead and gone, I'll be able to look at the tally, and I've got my sins on the one hand and my good deeds on the other, and so long as the good deeds outweigh the sins, I'm okay. This shouldn't come as any surprise to anyone who's been listening to this series, because Seville basically said this stuff throughout his career, most notably talking about when he goes to meet St. Peter at the Pearly Gates, and if Peter won't let him in, then I'll break his legs. That's really how Seville put this stuff out there. And the book was written in a very similar fashion. Seville did make something of a confession within this book, where he described himself as an abuser of things and body and people, and stated that when back in his dance hall days, when he would have someone get out of line in the club, they would hold them inside of the club until after everyone left, at which point Seville would have his bouncers beat the individual. He also went on to talk about how he had taken advantage of women, concluding with, "That shows you that the forces of evil are causing me to do something which, on reflection, I would rather not have done. I am frail like everyone else." I'm just putting that in there because years later, when Seville was being put up for a knighthood, stories started to come out in newspapers about how Seville may have roughed people up within the dance halls back in the 50s. Netflix documentary, they have an individual who worked on Margaret Thatcher's team during this period of time, and the man acted as though that this was information that had never been out there in the public until Thatcher decided she wanted Seville to go and be knighted, at which point this information came out, and the team who grants the knighthoods shook their heads and say no. As I stated a couple episodes back when I talked about the Netflix documentary, that's complete bullshit. They knew this information. It was out there in the public for years before Seville was ever considered for a knighthood. It was also around this period of time, 1978, that Jimmy Seville had his last professional wrestling match. And this match was against a man by the name of Exotic Adrian Street. Adrian is someone who I am pleased to count among my many acquaintances. And I was given the ability a number of years back to ask Adrian about the match that he had had against Seville, and I was able to do this because he was on a podcast with a former associate of mine. I say former because this individual and I are no longer friends. However, I am friends with the owner of the podcast network, a man by the name of Brian Last, who has been gracious enough to allow me to use the audio recording of Adrian Street discussing his match with Jimmy Seville. And I'd like to thank Brian and my friends at the Arcadian Vanguard Network for allowing me to use this audio clip. I'm going to set it up for you really quickly. Adrian Street, he's not a very large man, but he is what is known in professional wrestling parlance as a shooter or a hooker, which is to say someone who can legitimately injure an individual in the ring at will. Not just injure, but possibly kill them if the mood so takes them.
Jimmy Savo was a disc jockey. He really got over as a disc jockey. And he had a thing with the kids and everything like that, like Jim will fix it. And, like, if any young kids and every now and then made a wish, he'd sort of try to make it come true and everything, you know? and he was really over, but he wanted to put himself over as a tough guy. So he did all kinds of things. I mean, he sort of went into training with the Royal Marines because they have like a really tough schedule, you know. They have like a really tough form of training to actually make it as the Royal Marines. He did all that. He'd go on runs. He'd sort of do all kinds of things. Then there was a wrestler, gentleman Jim Lewis, actually brought him into the wrestling business on the independence, first of all. But the fact he was a big name, all of a sudden, joint promotions, some of the promoters in joint promotions started using him as a professional wrestler. And I had just had a match in Nottingham Ice Rink with the World Lightweight Champion, George Kidd. And not only did I beat George Kidd, it was a non-title match, unfortunately. Not only did I beat him in 7 minutes, bearing in mind that like 30, 45 minutes was like normal length time for matches in Britain in those days, because very often, unless it is a big show, you'd only ever have four matches on, like to sort of fill a whole evening with. This is a big show in Nottingham Ice Rink. Not only did I beat the lightweight champion of the world in a non-title match, but I beat him in 7 minutes, and he ended up, he had to go to hospital because I sort of really did his legs in. He ended up in Nottingham Infirmary. Anyway, I challenged him to a title match, but he wasn't well enough. I heard his legs that bad. He wasn't well enough to actually wrestle on the next show in Nottingham Ice Rink. They used to have it once a month there. So I was there on the next show, and I expected him to put me on with somebody, you know, somebody good, somebody meaningful. I couldn't believe it when I turned up. They actually had me wrestling with Jimmy Savile. I was absolutely horrified. Then the next thing is, Ted Beresford, who was the promoter, came into my dressing room with Jimmy Savile, introduced me to him. He said, "This is your opponent tonight." I said, "Yeah." I said, "I know." I said, "I got a bone to pick with you over that." Then he turned around, you won't believe this, he wanted me to fix the fight, and he wanted me to do a draw. He said, "You get one fall each. You want me to do a draw, actually. You actually want me to fix the bloody fight and actually do a draw with a bloody dish jockey after I just beat the world champion." Well, there was no way I'd have it. And the thing is, it turned out, we didn't know the extent of it at that particular time. It turned out that Jimmy Savile was a pedophile. He'd mess with little boys and he'd mess with little girls and things like that. Jim will fix it if they left the kids alone with Jimmy Savile, then he'd molest them. But they didn't know about it at the time. We didn't know about it. Now, he used to post about his conquest and stuff like that with young girls, but we didn't know how young. And if I'd known that, he wouldn't have left that bloody ring alive. I wouldn't have beaten him. Anyway, we went in the ring. Now, I always like to go in the ring second. I didn't like going in the ring first because the thing is, it was better for me, it was better for my opponent. If I'm wrestling with a good guy opponent and stuff like that, if he went in the ring first, people could cheer him and all the rest of it, because once I get in the ring, I don't stop performing. And if my opponent came in second, I mean, I would still be performing and doing whatever it was and getting a lot of attention. It was better if my opponent went in the ring first, got all the cheers and all that kind of stuff. Now, Ted Beresford knew that, and because I told him, forget it. Ted Beresford said to me, hey, Reedy, said, don't forget. He said, don't underestimate Jimmy. He said he'd done his training with the Royal Marines. He said he's a real tough guy. I said, yeah, we'll see how tough he is when we get in there. So I was, you know, I mean, I was not happy at all. Anyway, the next thing is Ted Beresford comes running. He said, "Everyone, they're playing your music, they're playing your music. You need to get in there. Jimmy's in there already." Anyway, I ran out. He wasn't in the ring. They're playing the music, and I sort of got to the top of the thing where they put the spotlight on, and the crowd had seen me, so I had to go. You know, I mean, I would run back in the dressing room there and see me, you know. So I went in there, so you can imagine now, I mean, my temper's boiling, I'm getting worse and worse and worse. So I've gone in there, I've gone in the ring and all the rest of it. The next thing is they play all this, some music and everything like that, that Jimmy Savile used to play as, you know, as a disc jockey and everything. And here he comes, and damn it, he's got his hair dyed a funny colour. He's got a gown on that's like a garish copy of what I wear. So he comes in and everything like that, and he's aping me. Oh, I mean, is he? You know, I mean, he's like coming in doing like an Adrian Street thing, except he can't, I mean, nobody can do it except me. But you can tell what he's trying to do and all the rest of it. So anyway, I'm not going to give him the satisfaction. I mean, all the people now want to sort of see my reaction. They want to see me getting upset. But I'm not going to do it. I sort of turned around, and I started yawning and everything like that, looking everywhere, but not my opponent. So I was telling myself, well, at least I'll wait until he gets his gown off. And then I'll sort of go into my act and sort of just take it away from him, you know what I mean? Anyway, he gets in there, and through the corner of my eye, I can see he's taking his gown off. So right, they announce me, and I turn around, start to take my gown off. I look over at him then, because I'm doing my thing. And damn me, he had one gown on top of another one. So he took it. I see him through the corner of my eye, take his gown off. The next thing is, I turn around, he's got another one on. So he's done me. I mean, the guy has done me again. And I could be very pleasant, I could be very polite. I believe in politeness. But piss me off and I could be really ignorant. Anyway, like that, you can imagine that this guy has really, really, really pissed me off. So anyway, the time he starts messing about and everything like that, I turn around back in the corner again and I'm going to take no notice of him. When he finally gets all his gowns, he had about four gowns on, one on top of the other. So, I mean, he's doing me while I'm in the corner, like, pretending to take no notice of him. When that bell went, Linda wasn't in the business then, but she was in the audience. When I came out and I said, did you see that? She said, oh, good, good. She said, you're like a fox chasing a chicken. I beat him inside out, upside down, all this wispy hair he had that he'd sort of dyed I don't know how many times. I was tearing out by the roots, all his head was bleeding. I kicked him, I smashed him, I drop kicked him so hard, it's a wonder he's still in orbit. But anyway, it must have taken me about 10 minutes before the referee stopped it and everything like that. Well, I submitted him, and then I submitted him again. I just didn't want to let him go. But anyway, I did absolutely destroyed him, and he never, ever, ever wrestled again. Now, the funny thing is, he actually owned a club in Bournemouth and started running wrestling shows there. Now, the thing is, I was a big draw there, so he had me on the show down there whenever he could get me. Now, normally, he would be there, head cook and bottle washer, running about, you know, so everybody could see him. I never, ever saw him again in my life, even though I was wrestling on some of the shows, on a lot of the shows that he had in the club in Bournemouth. I never saw him again. Do you know, he was made an OBE by the Queen. He was actually knighted, and he was an actual fighter. This is after he was, after I put him out of wrestling. He was actually knighted by the Queen, and he was Sir Jimmy Savile.
Again, I would like to thank my friends at Arcadian Vanguard Podcast, specifically Brian Last, for allowing me to use that piece of the show that Adrian was on. you can find Arcadian Vanguard on Facebook and on Twitter. Look for 605 Super Podcast. You can also hear Brian weekly on the Jim Cornette Experience and the Jim Cornette's Drive Thru. I'm going to call it there for this week. We are now into 1979. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave a 5-star review. Till next week, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Stay morbid.